try and understand. Desire is hunger, is the fire I breathe. Love is a banquet on which we feed.
Smith singing Because the Night, co-written with Bruce Springsteen. I'm Emily Auerbach, and this is University of the Air. She has been called Punk's Poet Laureate, a revolutionary figure whose work had a profound impact on rock and roll, visual art, and poetry. A feminist icon, a transformative artist and activist who entertained and empowered millions. Why Patti Smith Matters is the title of a new book by my guest today, music journalist Karen Rose. Karen, welcome to University of the Air.
Thank you so much for having me.
So let's imagine that you're sitting on an airplane on the way to do a book signing of Why Patti Smith Matters, and you're next to a college student who's maybe 20 and her grandmother in her mid-80s. And when they find out what you're doing, they say, "I've never heard of Patti Smith." How do you explain Patti Smith in just a few sentences to a younger generation and maybe an older generation that has never heard of her?
She was an pioneering and influential artist that was at the forefront of what we call punk rock, at the beginning of punk rock in the United States. And she's also a poet and a writer and a visual artist. And she lived in the Chelsea Hotel with the photographer Robert Mapplethorpe, who she met at a very young age. And the two of them worked together to get themselves on a path where they could live as artists.
And if you had to do a definition of punk rock, how would you describe it?
Punk rock is about, I don't like to use the cliche, the first thing that came in my mind is living your truth. Living your truth, singing your truth, writing your truth, making the art you want to make at the point where you couldn't possibly do anything else. You know, at the beginning of quote-unquote punk rock, it was a reaction to what rock and roll had become after the 50s and the 60s and into the 70s, which was lots, you know, rich people living in mansions playing 7-minute guitar solos. You know, punk rock was shorter and succinct and for the people and not for rich people sitting in English manors.
I noticed that in your book you make yourself and your reaction to Patti Smith part of the story. Can you talk about why you felt drawn to write a book, Why Patti Smith Matters, and how you responded to her personally before starting this book?
So as a music writer, we're not supposed to be in our pieces. Our pieces are supposed to be objective. And also as a woman music writer, I'm always so careful to make sure there's no shade of any personality in here, lest someone come in and accuse me of trying to incur favoritism towards the artist, like thinking that I'm a groupie, which is a thing that still happens even today in my advanced years. So in the first draft of this, I was definitely not in it as much as the series gives space for the writers to do, and was really challenged by my editors to put myself in here more. And, you know, I discovered her as, you know, a teenager, a young teenager, And to me, she was, it wasn't about punk rock, which I kind of understood, but not, wasn't sure. But she was a woman fronting a band. It was the Patti Smith group. It wasn't, you know, a group under another name like Heart that had Anna Nancy Wilson as the lead singer and guitarist. And that to me was just so, I hadn't seen it. I hadn't seen anyone that I could identify with before her. You know, she didn't conform to, you know, societal expectations of what women in the spotlight should look like or dress like, or, you know, as somebody that was always harangued to wear makeup. She wasn't wearing makeup.
You write in the preface to your book, Patti Smith was and still is a hero, a goddess, a field marshal, a saint. She was also just an awkward, skinny kid from South Jersey. Whether we were from New Jersey or anywhere else on the planet, we recognized ourselves in her sharp angles and her inability to fit into the normal world, normal in quotes. But instead of slinking stealthily through it, she insisted on being seen and heard. That's beautifully said. So you saw in Patti Smith someone strong and unconventional, unafraid to be herself unapologetically.
And I think I say this later. I do this a lot. What did I write this in the book or was this in my head? You know, she showed us that you could get out, you could survive, and you could thrive as yourself, which was incredibly important, especially in that time period.
Could you set up an excerpt from Piss Factory? And I should say there are parts of Patti Smith that we can't play on the radio in terms of language. She definitely does not stay away from all kinds of expletives. But can you set up Piss Factory in terms of that message of getting out and tell us a little bit about her early years?
Patti grew up in a working class family in very south, what was rural New Jersey at the time. And both of her parents worked. She was the eldest child, so she was, you know, taking care of her siblings even at a young age. And the only places you could get work down there, and she had to get work once she was old enough, were factories. Piss Factory is a poem that she wrote about. It was once described by a Detroit journalist as her poem about union peace work, which it is, and how she is in this factory doing this repetitive work over and over again, and she is surviving by daydreaming, by remembering the art that inspires her, the art she wants to make. And she ends it with, say, you know, I'm going to get on that train. I'm going to go to New York City. I'm going to be a big star. And I will never return. I will never return to this piss factory. And I will travel light. Oh, watch me now.
And then we'll drop in an excerpt there. Okay. Coming back out of that. As you listen to that, what do you hear in her voice and in the instrumentation that makes you know, ah, yeah, that's Patti Smith, no one else?
It's the way she phrases, it's the energy. She's channeling the energy of rock and roll into poetry. She's making you, you know, pay attention. It's also in that particular version of Piss Factory, it's definitely her Jersey accent, which I'm from the East Coast, so I can hear it. But the sort of nascent kineticism in how she moves you through the story, you know, it has as much tension and emotion as a great rock song.
And she did go to New York, right, to try to make it?
She went to New York to find work. There was no work down, you know, where she was living. There were only a few factories she was qualified to work in. And it was either New York or Philly. Those were the closest cities she could get to, she could afford to get to. And she had friends that were, you know, had gone to New York. So she knew she sort of had somebody to turn to. But, you know, she went to New York to get out of the rural Jersey, you know, stifling atmosphere. But you know, on the really just on the surface, she just went to try to find a job.
And how did she break in to music? It's a hard business.
It's a very hard business. And, you know, she didn't go to New York to front a band or to become a musician, but it was sort of part of her. She was a visual artist. She wrote poetry. She focused on the poetry. Robert Mapplethorpe said, I think you should think about setting it to music. Other people that came into her, other influential people that came into her life, the late Bob Neuwirth, who was, you know, a cohort of Bob Dylan's, introduced her to people. She got a poetry reading, and she decided, you know, it might be interesting if I put some guitar behind it. And she had made friends with this music journalist slash guitar player slash record store clerk named Lenny Kay, and said, do you think you could make your guitar sound like a car crash? And he said, yeah, I think I can do that. And they rehearsed, and she appeared at the St. Mark's Poetry Project and really, you know, kind of knocked everyone's socks off. And that's when she had, you know, people were coming, you know, offering her record deals, offering to manage her, offering to, you know, put her in bands, offering to, you know, all the offers were pouring in because she had made such an impression. And she just kind of dropped back and was and said to herself, I need to figure out who I am, what I want to do. And, you know, working with Lenny Kay, they did a few more of these poetry slash rock and roll events. She staged these evenings called Rock and Rimbo, where she was, you know, reading poetry and, you know, and again, backed by Lenny Kay, occasionally a keyboard player, and people were drawn to it. And from there, you know, they added a piano player. They added Richard Soul. They added a guitarist. They created a band and started writing rock songs.
What's a good song to hear that early Patti Smith band when it started to be a band with a distinctive style?
From Horses, I would go with Free Money or Birdland.
Let's hear Birdland.
Father died. We left him a little farm in New England. All the long black funeral cars left the scene, and the boys just standing there alone, looking at the shiny red tractor. But him and his daddy used to sit inside and circle the blue fields and grease the night. It was as if someone had spread butter on all the fine points of the stars, because when he looked up, they started to slip. Then he put his head in the crooks of his arms and he started to drift, drift,
He was not human.
little boy's face lit up with such naked joy that the sun burned around his lids and his eyes were like two suns. White lids, white opal, seeing everything just a little bit too clearly. And I looked around and there was no black ship in sight. No black
female. What do you hear in Birdland that strikes you?
So Birdland to me is quintessential Patti because it's a strong narrative and an emotional delivery, and she sets a scene and she pulls you into it, and it's her words are just the band behind her are matching her vocal delivery, her energy. It creates action, it creates movement, and it engages your imagination. I didn't know who Birdland was based loosely off of until much later, and it didn't matter. I had my own pictures in my head. There's also a significant section in the middle where live it's an improvisation. She's played the clarinet. She's just recited poetry, but it's never the same thing because the band know this is the improv. This is a section where anything can happen, and it does. And it, you know, it's a story about dreams and spaceships and loss and, you know, a son losing his father. And it's a sort of crazy in a good way. I hear abandon. I hear freedom. It's a song that I never, when she came back to public life in the mid 90s, I didn't think that was some of the material she would continue to do. And she does. And it's still just as thrilling as it was the first time I heard it.
Let's loop back to the other song you mentioned, Free Money. Can you set that one up? Because now I've got to hear that one.
So Free Money it originates from something Patti's mother, Beverly, used to do. She used to think about what would happen if I bought a lottery ticket and what would I buy if I won? How would my life change? And her mom never actually bought a lottery ticket. They did not have that kind of money, but it was the exercise of imagination and freedom. And you feel it. And there's that beautiful tension that the Patti Smith group can create, you know, between the guitar and the piano and Patti's voice and the space that they give her, to create this vision and this opening and this energy.
Here's a little bit of Free Money.
Every night before I go to sleep, find a ticket, win a lottery, scoop the pearls up from the sea, cash them in and buy you all the things you need. Every night before I rest my head, see those dollar bills go swirling at my bed. I know they're stolen, but I don't be bad.
So as we hear that, what part did Patti play in it? Is she both writing the words, writing the music, also sort of orchestrating it in terms of what the instruments are doing and playing guitar herself?
No, she is not playing. She plays guitar as ornamentation. She's not a straight-ahead guitar player. She didn't start playing really she didn't really learn any sort of chords until her husband, Fred Sonic Smith, who was in the MC5, taught her much later. But she's writing the lyrics. She's working with the band, various members of the band, to write the music. They're all working. She knows how she wants it to sound. But she's got Lenny Kaye and she's got Richard Soul, her pianist, and they collaborate. It's a collaboration, but the words are hers.
Another song that's a famous collaboration she did is Because the Night, co-written with Bruce Springsteen, and we're going to talk about that when we continue in a moment with University of the Air. Make your interactions with people transformational, not just transactional. That's a quote from Patti Smith, a punk rock icon, activist, poet, and an inductee into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Karen Rose, and we're talking about her book, Why Patti Smith Matters. It says on my book jacket for your book that this is the first time a book about Patti Smith was written by a woman. Do you think that matters, that you're coming at her story, her work, from the point of view of a woman?
I think it matters that it's not through the male gaze. And it's not through the centered on an expression of the white, an evaluation of through the white male experience. There's, especially in the 70s, you know, the sort of ethos of rock critics. You know, I joke that it's not really funny. I have a file in my work database for this book where I just kept track of every quote from a music journalist about her breasts, and there were multiple ones that they thought were, you know, was within their purview to offer their commentary on her breasts. They were too big, they were too small. She flaunted them. She didn't flaunt them enough. It's really ridiculous. I do think, you know, a lot of men reacted to her in a very, and they still do, in a very negative sense because of her physical appearance, because she is not conventionally attractive. And there's a lot of, you know, I can see the sort of undertones of this person is not attractive to me, and that's how I evaluate consciously or subconsciously their value to society. All of those things is why it makes a difference whether it's a woman behind it or yet another man.
And it seems as if Patti Smith embraced that stance of not conforming to mainstream notions of feminine beauty. There's a quote from her, "All I've ever wanted since I was a child was to do something wonderful. And also, even as a child, I knew what I didn't want. I didn't want to wear red lipstick."
I think it was less a gesture of nonconformity than just an expression of this is who she was. This is who she is. She doesn't know how to be any other way. And she wasn't, you know, she on the cover of Easter, she had to engage in a long conversation with her record company because you can see her armpit hair. And it still comes up. Again, here I am bringing it up. In this interview, because it was seen as, you know, they had to caution her, there may be record stores in the South that may not carry your album or may not place it prominently because that exists. The cover of Horses, initially the record company airbrushed out hair on her upper lip, and she had to go back to them and say, no, there's no airbrushing happening here. And that's less, I am doing that to make a point than it is, no, this is who I am. Like, this is who I am. I'm not anything else.
Yeah, nothing to hide, nothing to airbrush. That's a good way to think of it. In addition to being the first book about Patti Smith written by a woman, I understand that you had some exclusive time with Bruce Springsteen in terms of getting some of his comments about Patti Smith and their collaboration. Can you talk about that?
So it Bruce and Patty, it's a co-write on Because the Night. A lot of people think it's his song. A lot of people think that he gave her a fully finished song. And he didn't. And even as a teenager, I can remember going into record stores when Because the Night was a hit and hearing, you know, the hippie guys standing around, you know, hanging out in record stores, like, oh, Bruce is so angry that he gave her that song and he wanted that song. And it was sort of personal vindication for me to be able to go to Bruce to exclusively talk to him about his relationship with Patty, about how, not so much how that song got to her, because that story has been told many, many times, but you know, asking him, what was it like the first time you heard it on the radio? What did you think? Oh man, I shouldn't have given that song away. How did you feel about it? And then it's really interesting because he had finished his album. He had finished Darkness on the Edge of Town, and he had gone out on tour. And Because the Night wasn't in the set list, because it wasn't a finished song, you know, he said to me, you know, if she hadn't recorded it, that song would still be in the archives, because I didn't have a song. I had a chorus. I knew I had a chorus, and I knew I had a great hook, but a chorus and a great hook does not make a song. And as his tour moved along, and Patty's version of Because the Night began to move up the Billboard charts, he realized he needed to start singing this song and he needed to write lyrics to it. And the first couple versions of his version of Because the Night on his tour, it's a lot of mumbling because he didn't have the lyrics yet. As a music historian, it's a really fascinating thing to watch. But also just talking with him and him being like, he's like, did I think it was going to go to the top 10 or whatever? And he's like, no, because none of us were exactly doing that then. You know, and he's a fan, and he understands her approach. You know, his approach to live music is more from based on, you know, the tradition of the rhythm and blues artists, your James Brown, your Sam and Dave, you know, and he describes her as like as a shaman, like she is raising energy. You know, and he was also really interested the fact that as another working class kid from New Jersey, she was writing about working people. Which was very interesting to him. He hadn't quite started doing that yet and would head that way.
Let's hear more of Because the Night. As you listen to that, what do you hear in that that is Patty's? What do you hear in it that is Bruce's? And why was this such a hit?
What I hear in it that's Patty's is it's the verses. It's the story. You know, she's told this story that, you know, Jimmy Iovine, who was producing her record, but was an engineer on Springsteen's record at the time, had brought her the song because he felt she didn't have a hit yet. And he really wanted, this was going to be his first record as a producer, and he wanted it to be successful, and he wanted her to be successful. And he brought her the tape, and she was like, I don't want to cover somebody else's songs. You know, it's important that the music on my records is written by me and the members of my band. And she didn't listen to it, and she didn't listen to it. And one night she was home, and she was her boyfriend at the time, Fred Smith, was in Detroit, and she was waiting for him to call. And he didn't call, and he didn't call. And she's sort of pacing her apartment, and she saw the tape, and she's like, all right, I'll listen to the tape. And Fred didn't call until midnight, but by then she had written all the lyrics. So I hear the story of their I hear their love story. I hear, you know, the line that I love the most in that song is "Love is a ring, the telephone." You know, it's a little antiquated, but it just says so much in so few words.
So that line where she's playing on the ring of a phone plus the ring that you might have, you know, a wedding ring kind of thing, that's all Patty, the words?
I don't think she's playing on wedding rings. I think she's just she's waiting for Fred to call. And so to her, love is hearing the telephone ring.
But she's writing the lyrics.
Yes.
Yeah. Is it a bit ironic that maybe her best known song is the one she co-wrote with Bruce Springsteen when she wanted so much to be kind of her own independent artist completely?
So it's the song that, you know, put her kids through college, but Dancing Barefoot is actually the song that is the most covered because The Night is a very hard song to sing. So people tend to not try it.
Well, let's talk about Dancing Barefoot. Where did that fit in her repertoire? You know, at what point in her life was she when she wrote Dancing Barefoot?
Dancing Barefoot is on Wave, which is the last record she made in her first sort of appearance in the music business. She knew it was going to be her last record at that time, at that phase of her career. It's beautiful. It's haunting. It's that sort of mystical, quasi-mystical, yet very rock, still very rock experience that she could craft, and she still crafts. It's not that it represents a people are. It's not that people are covering it because it represents a particular time. It's just because it's a beautiful song.
Do you have a favorite line from Dancing Barefoot?
The sort of fade out where she says, oh, God, I feel the fever. Oh, God, I feel the pain. Oh, God, forever after. Oh, God, I'm back again. That.
And do you have a favorite cover?
Yes. I was going to just suggest U2 has a great cover.
Okay, we'll hear a little bit of that.
She is a benediction. She is addicted to heat. She is the root connection, and she is connecting with me. Here I go and I don't know why I spin so ceaselessly. Could it be he's taking over me? I'm dancing barefoot, headed for a spin. Some strange music drags me in. It makes me come up like some heroin.
You've alluded to various relationships in her life with Robert Mapplethorpe, with Fred Smith, and also that she left the sort of music performing business for a while. We're going to talk about those personal relationships and also how she wound up singing at the Nobel Prize ceremony that a Bob Dylan song when he was going to be receiving the Nobel Prize. More on Patti Smith when we return in a moment with University of the Air.
Equation to explain the division of the senses. No sound to reflect the radiance of time. In the beginning is dream, halls of disorder, where we are swept to encircle dawn, strapped in a low car, racing through silence, trumpeting bliss.
That's from It Takes Time by Patti Smith and Fred Smith, married at the time. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Karen Rose. We're talking about her book, Why Patti Smith Matters. Can you talk about her marriage to Fred Smith, who already had the name Smith, so she didn't have to change her name when she got married, and about the role of marriage and motherhood in her life?
You know, she and Fred had a long-distance relationship for a long time, and she, you know, they both reached the point where they didn't want to be apart. And Patti was already struggling with what the position that she found herself in as a rock musician. You know, she felt that, again, like as it was that first time she read at St. Mark's, at the St. Mark's Poetry Project, you know, she was getting opportunities that she didn't feel that she had earned. And she kind of saw the danger in it if she couldn't explicitly articulate it or wasn't willing to articulate it. But she moved to Detroit, and she and Fred, you know, set up housekeeping. They had two kids. She was still working. She was still writing. The New York Public Library is part of the research for the book. The New York Public Library has a couple of notebooks of hers that are from the late 70s time period. And, you know, she was still working. You know, she was still getting up every day, and like every mother of young children who is an artist knows, she made time for her art, for her studies, for pursuing her interests. She just wasn't doing it in New York City, and people were very unkind about that decision on her part. For a lot of reasons that had nothing to do with what she was actually doing, It wasn't, oh, we miss you. Oh, we were looking forward to the next album. It was sort of, people were personally disappointed that she was no longer hanging around and making records. They had plans to do that, but they were raising a family, and the kids did not know who their parents were. Jackson Smith, her son, didn't know his father was in the MC5 until he was meeting his former bandmates at his father's memorial service. Patty says there's an interview she gave where she talks about how for the longest time she and Fred were just her. Jackson was such a popular and engaging kid that everyone just knew them as Jackson's parents. And she really loved that.
You mentioned Fred's memorial service, and Patty went through a lot of loss with Robert Mapplethorpe and with her husband, Fred. Can you talk about that and about how she transformed that grief into art?
So she lost Robert. She lost Fred unexpectedly. And then she lost her brother, who was, listen, I know Fred's gone, but the plan was for you guys to get back into the music business now anyway, that the kids are older. Her brother had been her road manager in the 70s, and he was like, I will, quit my job. I will go back out with you. We're going to do this. And then a month later, Todd passed away, also unexpectedly.
How did she transform the pain of those losses into art?
This was how she, this was her career. This was her profession. She needed to come back into it. Fred had been teaching her chords, and she just started using those chords and sitting down at night and playing them and writing songs and coming up with ideas. And by the time Lenny Kay came out to Michigan to work with her, she had this collection of material, and he said that he was really moved by how she took her grief and through work was transforming it into art, that she would just sit down and play until she had a song. Similarly to that, that was when she started working with Polaroid photography, because she, was overwhelmed by grief, but she still felt that need to be fulfilling her purpose and still being able to work. Not from a honor the grind kind of techie way, but in a, work is why we're here and our purpose. And she had a Polaroid camera, and setting up a shot and taking a picture, one picture, was some days that was all she could accomplish, but at least she had accomplished that. And that really moved into an art form that she embraced. She has a book coming out in November that's a collection of those of her Polaroids. And then the next step was going back out on the road, performing live. And she was rehearsing with a local band in Detroit, friends of Fred's. And, that got her to the point where she could put a band together. She went back to work with Lenny Kay and J.D. Dougherty, who was her first drummer, as she said at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, my only drummer. And they put a band together, and she went back out on the road.
She also wrote Just Kids, about her relationship with Robert Mapplethorpe, and which became a National Book Award. That's a lot earlier, but you see her taking relationships and then doing things with that. One of the songs that you mention in the book as your favorite is Beneath the Southern Cross. Can you tell us about that one?
Beneath the Southern Cross to me is a song that represents the sort of old Patti Smith group and the new Patti Smith group. It's one of those songs that raises energy. It's a song that has space for interplay and improvisation. It's a song inspired by grief. It's a song inspired by mourning. It's a song inspired by loss. And it it's a sort of shape-shifting being that is something different every time she performs it live. And sometimes it's incredibly energetic and powerful, and other times it's the kind of thing that can rip your heart out of your chest because of the grief and the loss that you can feel in it. It's the song I listened to on a loop the night my father passed, and I was sitting there writing his obituary. Mm-hmm. And I found it incredibly comforting. So that is, it's a song I think she does not get enough credit for. It stands with any of her work from the early 70s, in my opinion. And it's a really tremendous piece of art.
One of the times when Patti Smith was thrust into sort of a global spotlight was at the Nobel Prize ceremony, where Bob Dylan had declined to be present when he was awarded the Nobel Prize in Literature. Can you talk about that?
So this is one of these definite connections, kismet. This is definitely kismet, because Patti had been invited to perform at the Nobel ceremony before they knew it was going to be Dylan winning the award. And she had prepared for that ceremony, and then she found out it was Bob winning. So now she has to perform a Bob Dylan song, and she was incredibly nervous. And it wasn't that she didn't know the material. She is nothing if not someone who is constantly prepared. But she explained this when she wrote an op-ed for the New York Times, probably to sort of answer all the questions about what happened. And she was just overwhelmed. She was overwhelmed. She lost her place. And she, you know, she did what I thought was an incredibly brave thing, which was stop and ask if she could start again. And she did. And that got, you know, so much attention because it's an uncharacteristic thing for anyone to do. We're supposed to sort of vamp through things. We're not supposed to make mistakes. We're supposed to be perfect. And here she is on this very public stage in front of, you know, literal kings and queens. And she just did what she needed to do to get back into the song. In the op-ed, she talks about how many of the scientists came up to her the next morning and said they were really moved by it, and they appreciated that she just stopped and she started over again. And they're like, we have all made huge mistakes in public, and we saw ourselves reflected in your actions last night.
I think what struck me listening to that and also to her conversations about it later is the authenticity, the humility, the humanity. You know, I think that Patti Smith offers herself in an unvarnished way and in a way that embraces other people to come forward, whatever their flaws might be, whatever their imperfections. And I feel that, too. Maybe we can go out on this song. I feel it in the song, People Have the Power. Before we hear it, first of all, let me thank you, Karen Rose, for being my guest and for your book, Why Patti Smith Matters, which really helped me understand an artist I didn't know enough about. So I'm grateful for that. But can you set up People Have the Power before we hear it?
So People Have the Power was an idea from Fred Smith. And as Patti's told the story, he came into the kitchen when she was making dinner, and he said, people have the power. Write it. And she did. She studied speeches by, you know, famous orators. She did some reading on history and wrote this incredibly powerful anthem that has gone, it has grown and shifted and morphed to become this great song, to become what Fred Smith wanted it to become. And it's gratifying to her to see people adapting it. I've seen, you know, countless quotes from the song on signs at various protest marches. I know that it's been sung at some protests, and that, you know, people have the power. Use your voice. And I was thinking about how she sometimes vamps on the song, you know, people have the power to vote, people have the power to strike.
I also like the line, people have the power to redeem the work of fools.
Yes, that is a line that's one of the lines I have seen on signs at marches and she's mentioned how gratifying it is to see those words out in public.
Let's hear People Have the Power. I'm Emily Auerbach, hoping you'll join us for the next hour of University of the Air.
I was dreaming in my dreaming.